Chapter 10. Dinner that evening was a quiet affair. We ate with the family once more in the great hall. It had become clear that this room served a variety of purposes. With the long table at one end, it was the dining room during meal times, but the cluster of armchairs and sofas at the other end, grouped about the hearth, meant that it also served as a sort of drawing room where the family gathered after dinner. Charles Hathaway explained that he worked from his estate office, a small room near the kitchens, and that the main public wing, comprising library, breakfast room, drawing room, and ladies' parlour, was in the process of renovation, as evidenced by the reams of wallpapers, carpets, paint pots, and scaffolding.
"And so the great hall must serve for now," he said,
as we rose and made our way to the table.
"But we are hardly within the walls these days. I am always out and about, either supervising the flocks or meeting with prospective constituents, and Mary is here, there, and everywhere, seeing to the renovations and the children. And, of course, Granna has her suite, where she is able to keep herself quite comfortably."
"Yes," Mary Hathaway said, with a tight smile at her grandmother-in-law. "Lady Hathaway is very happily settled in the master suite. We would not dream of asking her to move."
It was painfully apparent that this was exactly what she wanted, but Lady Hathaway seemed blissfully oblivious. She merely reposed herself in the most comfortable chair, nearest the fire, I noticed, and waited for the rest of us to sit.
"Jonathan returned with a headache this afternoon, but I have sent Anjali to ask him to come to us if it has eased," Lady Hathaway told us. "He ought to join our little party."
Charles and Mary exchanged glances but said nothing. Disposing of the natural history collection was entirely within Charles's rights as the heir to the hall, but it might appear tactless to make a show of doing it in front of the brother whose birthright he had usurped. Effie noticed the glance and gave her brother a sly smile.
"Well, that might put the cat amongst the pigeons," she said. "You are selling off the hall's treasures without Jonathan's approval."
"I do not require his approval,"
Charles began heatedly.
"Indeed, you do not."
The voice came from the shadows under the stairs, and I began to wonder if the Hathaways kept that particular doorway dark solely to accommodate dramatic entrances. A tall figure stood there, his broad shoulders blocking what little of the light shone from the hallway behind. He moved forwards into the warmth of the fire, the golden light playing over his features. I had wondered if I would recognize him, expecting that after 6 years and experiences that must have left their tragic mark upon him, I might find it difficult to say with certainty. But I knew him. His eyes settled curiously on me as Stoker rose and introductions were made. Hands were shaken. He came to me then and put out his hand.
"Miss Speedwell, how do you do?"
he said warmly. There was nothing of recognition in his gaze. He looked at me with the same polite dispassion he had demonstrated in greeting Stoker. I was a guest of his family, and nothing more. Whatever accidents and illness had befallen him, they had seemingly robbed him of his memory. I, who had known him so well, was a stranger to him. "How do you do, Mr. Hathaway?" I replied faintly. He shook my hand, a good, firm shake, and then seated himself at the table, careful to take the furthest, coldest, hardest seat.
"So, I understand you are here to assess the natural history collection?"
he asked, turning from me to Stoker. If he had taken offence at his brother's precipitous action in ridding the hall of some of its treasures, he did not betray it. His voice held no malice, and his expression was one of interest, but not antagonism. Yet Charles Hathaway must have been pricked by guilt, for he hurried to speak, a dull pink tinge rising in his cheeks.
I didn't like to trouble you. You have been unwell, and the arrangements were made quite suddenly.
Jonathan Hathaway smiled easily.
It is not my affair in any event, Charles,
he said in a mild tone.
The estate and the contents of the hall are entirely yours.
Quite right, Mary Hathaway put in. Now, you must tell me what you think of this preparation of oysters, Mr. Templeton Vane. I have had a dreadful time finding good help, you know. French chefs are not inclined to come and bury themselves in the country, so I must make do with the cook. But I think these oysters are rather good.
Stoker reassured her as to the delicacy of the dish, and, having successfully turned the conversational tide to gentler waters, she carried on, introducing a new topic for each course, and ensuring the talk remained general, rather than allowing any of us to speak quietly with our dinner companions. Each subject was designed to be a thoughtful prompt to engaging discussion, as formal and predictable as if she had followed an etiquette guide, which, upon reflection, I realized she most likely had. With soup, we discussed the forthcoming Exposition Universelle in Paris, while the fish overheard us chatting about the Lyric Theatre, opened in London the past December, and the merits of comic opera versus grand opera. The carving of the roast introduced the subject of the United States and its plan to permit a land rush in the unassigned lands of the Oklahoma Territory.
And with four new states this year already, Mary Hathaway said, in a tone heavy with disapproval. It is unseemly.
My dear Mary, Jonathan said gently, they are a young nation. They are still finding their way.
She gave an audible sniff, thereby dismissing all things American, and the conversation turned, with the serving of the salad, to travel at large. Stoker related a few amusing anecdotes of his time in Egypt, and Jonathan, who had participated in the conversation, fell silent, studying his plate with a furrowed brow as he laid his fork aside.
Jonathan,
his grandmother said, prodding him,
you have remembered something?
He shook his head slowly.
I cannot say. It was a flash of something, like a magic lantern show. Just an image, and only for a moment. I saw a tall tower, a minaret, I believe it is called, although how I know the word I could not say. I heard a strange call, unlike an English voice, and there were palm trees in a line next to a broad river of shifting colours, dark green and brown, and upon the sandbank, a crocodile with a small white bird perched atop its head.
He had spoken in a low monotone, his eyes fixed upon his plate, but as he came to an end of his recitation, he must have realized we were all attending to him, for he darted a look at his sister-in-law.
Forgive me, Mary. I seem to have got quite carried away. This salad is delicious. What is it dressed with?
He asked with an urgent sincerity. It was a fortuitous question, for Mary had had the receipt from the cook of a viscountess, and she held forth until the sweet course on the proper method. When we finished the sweet course, the ladies did not withdraw, there being no suitable room to withdraw to, as Mary Hathaway remarked with a tight smile. She was clearly chafing at the limitations of entertaining before her grand renovations were complete, but a few of the men servants appeared to move the table aside and group the chairs near the fire. Mrs. Desmond brought dishes of chocolates and nuts to arrange on small tables with coffee. Mrs. Hathaway dispensed the cups and fell into conversation with her husband and Stoker about the plans for the hygienic cottages to be built upon the moor. Lady Hathaway was dozing gently in her chair, but I felt restless and took a turn about the room. Jonathan Hathaway brought me a cup of coffee, which I detest, but accepted to be polite.
"Miss Speedwell, for you,"
he said with a gallant gesture. His gaze dropped quickly to the cup and saucer, and then rose again, holding mine for only a few seconds, but with such intensity that I could not possibly mistake his intentions. I thanked him, and he turned away at once to take his own cup from his sister-in-law's fair hand. I meandered about the great hall, moving from one rusted sword to another until I reached the furthest point from those gathered about the fire. With my back to them, I lifted the cup and found a tiny piece of paper, which I transferred instantly to my pocket. I poured the coffee into a handy aspidistra, which seemed to be suffering from anemia or melancholy, for it drooped in its pot, its etiolated leaves brushing the floor. I completed my turn about the room just as Lady Hathaway rose to say goodnight. Mary excused herself on the grounds that she wanted to look in on the children, and I took the opportunity to escape as well, leaving only the gentlemen to carry on, no doubt with port and cigars now that the ladies were absent. I had just reached the stairs when Stoker caught up to me.
"Well?"
he asked, gripping me by the elbow. "Well?" I blinked at him.
"Veronica,"
he said patiently.
"You are here to determine if Jonathan Hathaway is an impostor. Well, is he?"
I shook my head. "I am afraid I cannot tell you."
"But you knew him."
6 years ago," I reminded him. "He was scarcely more than a boy when I knew him, and would be more than 30 now. Men change a good deal. The passage of time and the gaining of experience leave their mark."
"True,"
he said, stroking his chin. He had been clean-shaven that morning, but a shadow of a beard darkened his jaw.
"I am a little suspicious of him,"
he said, leaning towards me with a conspiratorial air. My heart drummed a slow, heavy beat in my chest. "Are you indeed?" He leaned closer still, his eyes bright with strong emotion.
"Has it not occurred to you that he may be an altogether unscrupulous person?"
My face was hot, the blood warm in my cheeks. "Of course. Sir Hugo suggested as much. If he can raise the necessary funds, he might be planning to lodge a legal claim against the estate, or perhaps he simply means to appeal to the Hathaways' sense of decency to give him a share," I began. Stoker shook his head.
"No, nothing so straightforward as that. I mean something altogether more nefarious."
The drumming in my chest was loud enough I was certain he could hear it. "Nefarious? In what manner nefarious?" He shrugged, and his expression, usually open and forthright when we spoke, was decidedly oblique.
"He is likable, immensely so. And yet, it is surprising how often such an open and amenable character may conceal something entirely different."
I swallowed hard, my throat unbearably dry. "I do not know what you mean."
"Have you never known men who smile and then play the villain? The sort of men who lay claim to what does not belong to them?"
Our eyes locked, and for a long moment neither of us spoke. "Of course," I said at last, "we both have. Of what criminous activity do you think him capable?" His expression became, if possible, even more inscrutable. He opened his mouth, then gave a quick shake of the head, and when he did speak, I had the strongest sensation it was not what he intended to say.
What if he is after my thylacine?
Your thylacine? I asked, rearing back in surprise. He was smiling thinly, and I realized it was meant as a jest. I forced an answering smile to my lips, summoning a bright and bantering tone. As if anyone would want such a nasty-looking mammal.
Not merely a mammal. It is a marsupial, a member of the order of Dasyuromorphia, he informed me loftily, and far more interesting than any of your little butterflies. Not even Raja Brooke's birdwing can touch it.
Trogonoptera brookiana is one of the greatest marvels of the natural world, worth every crime one might commit to own it. He tipped his head, regarding me solemnly.
Not all crimes can be justified, Veronica.
Before I could respond, he brushed a kiss to my blush-warmed cheek, leaving me to wonder at the oddness of his conversation as I hurried on to my room. Mindful of the time, I carefully worked a goose feather from inside one of the pillows and extracted a small bottle of bath oil from my toilet case. Using the feather, I oiled the squeaky hinges of my door until it opened soundlessly. I did not undress. Instead, I lay, fully clothed, atop the coverlet for a long while, thinking. At last, long past midnight, I heard a door open and close next door, no doubt Effie retiring at last. Then followed the sounds of her readying herself for bed, various drawers and cupboards opening and closing, and a continuous low monologue directed at the dog Sir Hugo had given her, I surmised, who answered with a few brisk barks, which she corrected. At last, I heard the protesting creaks of aging bedsprings as she settled in. I counted to 1,000 in Greek, then slipped off my own bed and picked up my cloak, long and full and dark blue, before moving to the door. A small pad of cotton wool fitted into the bolt hole ensured that it closed as quietly as it opened on its newly oiled hinges, and I passed into the corridor, careful to keep to the shadow of my doorway until my eyes became accustomed to the gloom. A series of clerestory windows admitted the flat white light of the waxing moon. After several minutes, I could make out the shapes of the furniture that lined the hall, a few tables, the odd chair, an aggressively ugly statue. I used them as landmarks as I made my way to the staircase. The house made few sounds as I descended to the main floor. There was the dull chime of a clock striking the quarter hour, the groan of wooden beams felled centuries before, settling into old age like elderly bones. I remembered what Effie had said about grey ladies and black dogs, and cast more than one look over my shoulder as I moved through the house. But the only ghosts that walked with me were my own. The door from the hall into the side garden had been left unlocked, and I passed through, my feet making no sound upon the flagstone terrace. The heavy dew from the grass soaked through my slippers as I crossed to the summer house, my cloak pulled tight around me. There was no light inside, but I knew he was there. I slipped inside and closed the door carefully behind me. It was dark as a tomb inside the summer house, yet I could smell hot metal and knew he had brought a lantern. He eased open one of the shutters, and a small bar of light fell over my face, dazzling my eyes. He put the lantern on the floor and stepped forwards, smiling.
Hello, wife.
Chapter 11. Harry Spenlove, I said stiffly. I brandished the scrap of paper he had slipped between my cup and saucer. I got your note. The scrap of paper held a single word, dashed off in pencil. Summer house. No time had been indicated, but I had guessed he would want to meet as soon as possible. He tipped his head, his expression almost apologetic as he smiled at me.
I do hope my presence here is not distressing to you. For my part, I cannot tell you how good it is to see you.
He put out a hand as if to touch me, but paused at the last moment.
I could scarcely believe it when I walked into the great hall and saw you standing there. It seemed a dream.
It was rather unexpected on my part as well, I said tartly. You are supposed to be dead. Jonathan Hathaway is supposed to be dead.
Jonathan is dead.
His lips pursed.
Poor fellow. I quite liked him, you know. He was a good friend.
But you buried him under your name. I have had a few hours to work it all out, I said. Somewhere on your travels, after you abandoned me, Jonathan died, and you took the opportunity to begin anew under his name.
Well, I had creditors,
he began. You had a wife, I spat. Or did it strike you as a trifling matter to leave me behind with everything else you had grown tired of?
Tired of you? Never,
he said fervently.
But, Veronica, things were insupportable. You even said as much when I bade you farewell. If I hadn't died, you were going to leave me in any event.
But you did not die, I pointed out acidly. You survived and did not see fit to tell me. Did it never occur to you that I might want to know?
Yes,
he said, so simply and with such conviction that I felt the wind ebb a little from my sails. He stepped closer.
I know you think poorly of me, but you must believe me. I never thought you would be in danger. Like everyone else, I thought that volcano was just kicking up a bit. I thought Jonathan and I would have a chance to go to Java and perhaps make a bit of money. I intended to send some to you,
he added.
I know it was a villainous thing to leave you without warning, but I couldn't bear another argument, another moment of you looking at me. Well, exactly the way you are looking at me now. So when Jonathan suggested we take a little trip to Java, it seemed like the best possible thing for both of us. But poor Jonathan contracted a fever on the ship. He was half dead by the time we docked, and he went straight into hospital. That was a very dark time, the hours I spent at his bedside. I thought of all our grand adventures, suddenly at an end. He was the best friend I ever had, you know.
He paused and wiped at his eyes.
I sat with him while he died. He was delirious with pain and fever, and he kept calling for this place, for his grandmother. And then he just slipped away. I spent my last coin on a bottle of the best champagne I could find to share with him, a toast to the afterlife,
he said ruefully.
I was rather the worse for wear when he finally died. The nursing sister who had been attending him had just left, you see. The new one brought a ledger, some ghastly bureaucratic necessity, but she was young and inexperienced, and my Dutch was as bad as her English. She was confused, you see, as to which of us had died. I opened my mouth to correct her, but then I thought suddenly about the creditors still hounding me. I thought about the papers Jonathan had given me as he lay dying, his passport and signet ring and a packet of letters from home. All things that could establish my credentials. And the description in the passport applied equally well to both of us. Brown hair and eyes, medium build. I was a little slighter, but with his clothes hanging a trifle loose, it was easy to convince people I had just recovered from a fever. I was a trifle shorter, but not enough to matter so long as I stood up straight. So I wrote out the forms in the name of Henry Spenlove, and Jonathan was buried under my name.
But if he were buried as Harry Spenlove, then how did the Hathaway family hear of his actual death?
I cabled them, in the name of a British doctor,
he said, managing to look a little shamefaced.
It was only slightly dishonest,
he went on hastily.
Jonathan was, after all, gone. As soon as I sent the cable, I had well and truly crossed the Rubicon. I was Jonathan Hathaway from that moment on. My life as Harry Spenlove was finished.
As was our marriage, I remarked. His smile was bittersweet.
I think that was well and truly done before I left. You made it quite clear you were having doubts. I took that badly. I knew I had behaved poorly, but I thought with Jonathan's name I could put it all behind me. I could be different. And my family are all gone,
he said simply.
There was no one to hurt by the loss of Harry Spenlove. Jonathan and I had planned to go on to South America together, so I booked passage to Santiago. When I arrived, the Chilean authorities accepted my masquerade. I collected Jonathan's letters from the Poste Restante, and there was one waiting from his grandmother with a £5 note in it, bless her. I was stony broke by that point, you understand, but with that note I was able to feed myself and buy a new set of clothes and take a comfortable room. And I was grateful to the old dear. I felt sorry for her. I realized the news of Jonathan's death would be difficult for her to bear. So I read the letters he had given me. Long letters from her, full of news of home. I got to know Lady H, you see. It was one-sided, of course. I longed to write to her, but I could not. I was living as Jonathan, and he was supposed to be dead and buried. But I read those letters over and over again, and, well, I became quite fond of her, really.
Fond of her?
I know it sounds ludicrous, but you must understand. For the past 6 years I have travelled, mostly in the Americas, never staying very long, never really getting to know anyone. It has been a lonely life, Veronica. Lady Hathaway has been my only constant.
I shook my head. You have done the cruelest thing imaginable, Harry. Jonathan is dead, but you have given them hope. He winced.
It was never my intention, believe me. Matters got entirely out of hand. I only meant to get out of Sumatra with my skin intact and lay quite low. South America, I decided. A good place to start over as Jonathan Hathaway. I bought a small farm and tried my hand at growing coffee.
You? A farmer? I tried to keep the scorn from my voice, but I was not successful. You have not done an honest day's work in the whole of your life. He looked affronted.
I will have you know that I applied myself, Veronica. I cleared land. I ploughed. I had blisters upon blisters and calluses that would have made you weep for the state of my hands. As it happens, I was unlucky. The rains that year were positively monsoonal. Wiped out the whole crop and I was ruined. I had to flee, once more with creditors on my heels. I set up again in the Argentine. I planned to open a gambling den, but the authorities were a little too curious. So I tried again, Mexico, then America. I thought I could lose myself in the West, prospecting for gold in California.
And how did you manage to ruin that?
I believed a pack of lies,
he said darkly.
To hear them tell it, nuggets of gold are simply waiting to be plucked from the riverbeds. The truth is rather more bleak. It must be dug out, slowly and painfully. Almost as bad as opal mining in Australia.
Which is what you had just given up when I first met you, I reminded him. His face lit.
So it was. Heavens, that was a lifetime ago. I shudder to think what might have happened if Jonathan and I hadn't met in Sydney and decided to travel together. Of all the benighted countries I have known, Australia must certainly be the worst.
What is your intention here, Harry? You realise all I need do is walk into that house and tell them the truth, and your little charade is over.
Oh, you mustn't,
he said, his voice anguished.
Not yet. It isn't finished.
If you think I intend to stand by and watch you fleece these poor people out of their estate...
Good God, that's not what I want. I have had quite enough of land, thank you very much.
I do not comprehend why everyone is so enamoured of land. Do you have any notion of how much work it is? No, indeed. Then what do you want? I demanded.
He ducked his head, and when he spoke, his voice was low.
You won't believe me.
Then be persuasive.
Very well. I have grown fond of Lady Hathaway. She is the nearest thing I have to family. Sir Geoffrey's death hit her terribly hard, and her health has suffered.
He added, looking away. He suddenly clamped his mouth shut, as if damning strong emotion, a small muscle working furiously in his jaw.
And you think she ought to spend her last months with someone pretending to be her grandson?
But to her I am Jonathan, so why can't I be?
The question was presented, as Harry presented all his most outrageous schemes, in so reasonable a tone that it seemed perfectly plausible.
Because you are not Jonathan Hathaway, I reminded him.
What does that matter? Jonathan is dead. If I am exposed, then she has lost him forever. So long as she calls me Jonathan, then she has a grandson. And what is in a name?
And that is justification for lying to her, for leaving her broken-hearted.
Who said a word about leaving?
He asked, his mouth quirking into a crooked, winsome little smile I remembered only too well.
You cannot be serious.
As the grave, my dear. It is a comfortable enough place, although gloomy, I grant you, and Mary is dreadfully bossy, and her children are frightful, and Charles is so dreary, constantly wittering on about sheep. But I am content to remain here as long as Lady Hathaway lives.
And when she dies? I demanded.
He shrugged.
I will spin a pretty tale for the family. I will simply tell them that it is difficult to remain here with Lady Hathaway gone, and I suspect, with the greatest irony, that it will actually be true. I will leave them as I came, quickly and without fanfare. Perhaps the odd postcard on my travels, but nothing more. I will be a footnote in the family folklore, the brief candle who flickered once again to life before slowly fading. I will ask nothing else of them.
He finished firmly.
And I will make Lady Hathaway entirely happy for the remainder of her time.
That might be years, I pointed out.
He shook his head mournfully.
No, I am afraid. The poor old darling has an extremely bad heart. She has died more than once, you know. The last time in my very arms.
You are joking.
I most certainly am not. I had to pour brandy down her throat to get her to come round again. The physician says it is a matter of months, if not weeks. Half a year at most. I will be on my way again by Michaelmas, I will wager.
I said nothing for a long moment.
That was the trouble with Harry Spenlove, I reflected. He made everything seem thoroughly reasonable until you escaped the circle of his charm, and then it was like waking from a spell. He moved half a step closer.
Veronica, please. She is the nearest thing I have to family. Do not make me leave her. Not now. Forgive me. I do not like to beg, but if that is what you wish, I will.
His voice broke a little, and unshed tears shone brightly in his eyes. He averted his head, clearly overcome by strong emotion.
She is a deeply unlikable old woman, I pointed out. How is it that you have become so attached to her?
He grinned.
I was reared by a woman very much like her, my own Granny Spenlove. As mean as the devil and twice as cunning. But her prickliness made it all the more meaningful when she decided she liked you. And she liked me very much. I was her favourite. I had almost forgot what it is like to be cared for.
He finished, looking sharply away. I tipped my head to meet his gaze and put a finger under his chin, lifting gently. Harry, I am deeply impressed by what you have told me. He looked sincerely hopeful.
Are you, love?
Yes, I said in a sober voice. I am impressed that you can still lie with such conviction. He gaped and then pushed my hand aside.
What the devil do you mean?
You do not have a sentimental bone in your body. There is a greater chance of fairies dancing upon the moon than you telling the truth. But I must insist you attempt it. Tell me, sincerely this time, why do you wish to stay here? Does it have anything to do with the altercation in Bristol? He opened his mouth, then snapped his teeth shut, grinding them.
Very well. Yes. I managed to run afoul of a particularly nasty pair. I thought I had eluded them, but they caught up with me in Bristol. They decided to provide a little demonstration of their feelings about me in the way of bruises.
He said sullenly.
It was not an especially enjoyable interlude. I got free of them as soon as I could, but they knew where I lodged, and I dared not stay. I knew they would immediately suspect I had gone to London to lose myself, so I headed west instead. It was only after I had boarded the train that I realized I was near to Hathaway Hall. Suddenly, the most elegant solution presented itself. I would simply take refuge here and enjoy her ladyship's company.
And her trust, I added.
I have taken nothing from this family, apart from borrowing a room that would otherwise go unused, and eaten their food, the price of which I have more than earned as a confidant and companion of Lady Hathaway.
He suddenly seized my hand.
Veronica, I will swear upon whatever you like, whatever I hold sacred. I have told you the truth. I am in grave danger if I am forced to leave this place. But so long as I am here, I am safe. And Lady Hathaway is happy. Can you not simply let this particular sleeping dog lie in peace?
He had given up pleading. He simply held my hand close to his heart and waited. I suppose you could force me, I said quietly. His expression was sincerely affronted.
If you are referring to your companion, I assure you, I have no interest in raising the fellow's ire. He is obviously besotted with you, but I should like to point out he is considerably larger than I, and you know how protective I am of my person.
He took a step closer still.
Veronica,
he said. In a low, coaxing voice.
Please. Jonathan was a good fellow. His grandmother loved him dearly, and she has been so very happy to have him back. Let me do this for her. And yes,
he paused, holding up a hand.
I know it will benefit me as well. I do not pretend to be nobler than I am, but to wrench that old dear's dream from her would be cruel, and say what you like about me. I am never that.
This much was true. Feckless, reckless, and utterly unreliable, but he had never been vicious. His failings were all the more painful for being delivered by someone who missed being a truly good man by so little. He wanted only a trifling bit of backbone, of moral courage, to be the man he ought to have been. He went on.
No one ever need know that we have been acquainted. We can continue on with our polite fiction of having just met, and you and the enormous Mr. Templeton Vane can finish your work and be on your way. What happens after will be just as I described it. I will allow Lady H to fawn and fondle as much as she pleases, and when her life draws to its natural close, I will be there, holding her hand. Her devoted grandson to the very end.
And then what? Perhaps Brother Charles will set you up with a tidy annuity before you leave. Is that what you hope? Payment for services rendered.
How cold you've become,
he said. his tone gently mocking.
But I suppose that crime may be laid at my feet. You must have grown up very quickly in the aftermath of the eruption.
Not that it seems to have concerned you. I could have bitten my tongue as soon as the words escaped me. They were petulant, and I had hoped it was beneath my dignity to care what he thought. To my astonishment, something like remorse flickered in his eyes, and he took my hand.
Veronica, you were always my greatest regret. Do not let me be yours.
I snatched my hand back. You assign yourself greater importance than you should. I do not regret you, Harry. I do not think of you. Likely sensing he had gone too far, he stepped back.
I understand. I hurt you deeply. And for that, I am truly sorry.
You left me during a cataclysmic disaster. I might have died.
Of course you weren't going to die.
He seemed genuinely shocked at the suggestion.
Veronica, you were, even then, the most resourceful person I have ever known. At 20, you could manage your affairs with as much aplomb as an army general planning a siege. It never once occurred to me that you mightn't survive. And I was right. Look at you. More ravishing than you were then, and entirely mistress of your own destiny. You have employment that suits you, a companion who clearly worships your very hem. You have health and beauty, and a wit so sharp a man might cut himself and think the bleeding a privilege.
I rolled my eyes at the transparency of the flattery, but he gave a good impression of a man speaking his mind. He put out his hand, as if to seize mine again, then drew it back.
I am at your mercy, sweet Veronica.
How very like you, to plead your case when you know I am as vulnerable as you, I said bitterly. You always did like to turn the tables. I suppose if I refuse, you will tell everyone the truth.
If you reveal my identity, then how we are acquainted with one another will, of necessity, be revealed,
he said evenly.
I will not deny it, and I will not lie.
Harry Spenlove, drawing the line at a lie. That is a new development.
You were always clever, Veronica, but you were never small. It is one of the things I admired most about you. There was never pettiness in you, and I do not believe you have acquired the habit of it. If you keep silent, then both of us will benefit. But most of all, a harmless old woman who cherishes her grandson will die happy. If you speak, you will bring pain to us both, and perhaps hasten her death. I leave it to you to judge if that is a weight your conscience can bear.
He moved to the door of the summer house and closed the lantern, plunging us into darkness. When he opened the door, moonlight flowed in, just bright enough to illuminate the path back to the hall.
Go first,
he urged.
I will wait and make certain you are not seen.
I had to pass him to exit the summer house, and when I did, I felt rather than saw him move towards me. It was a brief gesture, just a quick touch of one finger along my arm, but it raised shivers.
Whatever you decide,
he said softly,
I will not blame you.
Chapter 12. After my conversation with Harry, I did not sleep easily. Too many memories had been resurrected. I sifted through them all, remembering the first time I had met him, with Jonathan, aboard a steamer leaving Sydney. We were all bound for Sumatra, and they presented themselves as rivals for my affections, albeit good-naturedly. Before we passed through the Coral Sea, it became clear that something had quickened when Harry and I looked at one another. The air seemed to shimmer with possibility, and Jonathan took it with his usual grace. He and I formed a friendship of our own, founded upon our mutual love of lepidoptery. We exchanged stories of our best finds and our wish lists of specimens yet to be netted. We talked long into the night of bird wings and swallowtails, debating the merits and beauties of Papilionidae versus Pieridae. But at the end of our conversations, after we had said goodnight and gone our separate ways, Harry slipped into my cabin, and we passed the rest of those nights in a very different manner. I had been enchanted with Harry's easy manner. There was a lightness to him that indicated this would be a charming dalliance to offer refreshment to my spirit and body and nothing more. To my astonishment, he proposed marriage. I did not know then what troubles had befallen my mother upon this score. A hasty and intemperate marriage had led to her destruction, but it would be some time before I came to learn of this. I knew only that marriage, as an institution, was a thing to rouse wariness in my breast. The bearing of brats and ironing of shirts held little charms, I explained to Harry. But he kissed away every objection I made, promising that our lives would never be little or dull, that we would travel the world, making our own adventures, forever ardent lovers instead of allowing ourselves to fall into complacency. In the end, he wore me down, enticed me with a pretty picture painted from his words. I said the vows and signed the papers, and let him slip a slender, cold band of gold upon my finger. Within a month, the ring was gone, pawned to pay a debt, and I realized what I had done. I had shackled myself to a man who could not be trusted, upon whom I could never truly depend. Too late, I understood the magnitude of a woman's vulnerability in marriage, how every particle of her happiness depends upon her choosing well. And I had chosen unwisely. Jonathan had understood. Harry would frequently vanish, taking with him some small trinket or other to buy his way into a game of cards. Jonathan, who might have gone with him, often stayed carefully behind. I never quite knew what he intended. Was he guardian? Friend? Did he nurture hopes to be more should circumstances arise? Or did he simply act out of guilt or pity for a neglected bride whose rosy romantic dreams had been shredded? He never behaved badly, never put a finger upon me nor murmured a word to cause unease. Only once, after we had spent a particularly lovely afternoon filling our jars with the most extraordinary specimens of Troides vanderpoli, did he, flushed with success and spurred by high spirits, permit his hand to linger too long upon my arm. I looked up at him and saw a jolt of surprise, awareness springing to life before a deliberate closing of the shutters. Jonathan and I were never alone again after that day. He took great care always to invite others to join our expeditions, and even tried to leave once or twice himself. Harry always talked him round, but as our fledgling marriage crumbled even further, Harry seemed eager to escape. When Krakatoa began her fateful rumblings, it was Harry who arranged their jaunt to Java. It was meant to be a trip of less than a week, but a fortnight later I was still in Sumatra, twiddling my thumbs and waiting, growing more impatient with every passing hour. I was unaccustomed to ordering my life to suit another, and I had found I did not like it. I was preparing to make my own arrangements to leave when the volcano erupted in spectacular fashion. It is a time I seldom think on, and never with fondness. Water and food were scarce and unpalatable, and hygienic arrangements were unspeakable. The most rudimentary civilities were obliterated in the volcano's wake. Everything drowned in soot and mud and boiling seawater that heaved upon the beaches, leaving dead and rotting things behind. I stood at the stern of the boat as we sailed away, gripping the railing to stare behind until the palm-fringed islands fell beyond the horizon. I had never presented myself as a married woman. I had never called myself Spenlove, and Harry had taken my wedding ring. There were no photographs, no love letters, no tokens we had exchanged. There was nothing and no one to remind me of my foolish foray into matrimony. And so I forgot it. At least I tried. I worked hard, day and night, driving myself into exhausted and dreamless sleep, until at last Harry began to fade, like a snippet of a song, long since heard and half forgot. Never again did I refer to Harry. From that point on, I looked only to please myself, keeping my heart firmly locked away. I dallied, I flirted, I enjoyed myself immensely, but at all times I made certain my activities were undertaken to suit my own inclinations and not those of another. If I took one excellent lesson away from my marriage, it was that wifehood was not my calling, and was one I vowed I would never undertake again. And for a number of years, my resolve was never threatened. I had met a number of charming men, some more distracting than others. Some I enjoyed for an afternoon, some for a fortnight, but never longer and never at home. I reserved my escapades for my travels, always knowing I could retreat to England should I feel myself in danger of falling prey once more to my softer feelings. And yet it was in England that I met the man who was more myself than I was. I had observed before that if the rest of the world's folk were made of mud, Stoker and I were quicksilver, able to catch one another's thoughts as easily as a swallowtail may be netted on the wing. We did not require one another, for neither of us was deficient, but we enhanced one another, we bettered one another. I had always refused to entertain the possibility of marriage, and he had respected this, having had his own unwholesome encounter with that state. But I knew that in his heart of hearts there was a most traditional and conventional part of him that would have married me if I were willing to have him. In spite of his pain and his scars, he would have taken me as his wife, and the knowledge that I could not, would not, do the same troubled me. Was my love the lesser because I would not risk myself to keep it? Was I selfish or pragmatic? Was I true to my own nature, or was I everything nature abhorred? A woman who would not tie herself to a mate for the duration of her life. And now Harry had returned, blithely stepping into my life as a reminder that every day I had spent with Stoker had been a lie, a stain upon my conscience because I had withheld from him the facts of my own past. Stoker had, in due course, laid himself bare, giving me every part of himself, no matter how imperfect. And I had returned the favour by drawing a veil over that which I wished to conceal. I had not trusted him, and so I was repaid in betrayal, I reflected bitterly. It was with considerable self-loathing that I at last tumbled into an uneasy sleep full of fitful rest and broken dreams. I woke to find another grim morning had begun, the sun nowhere in evidence, hid as it was behind a bank of gloomy grey cloud. I completed my ablutions and went down to breakfast, my footsteps slowed by dread. I did not anticipate telling Stoker the truth with anything like pleasure. In fact, I was not at all certain of what words I should employ. How does one even begin such a conversation? And, of course, there was the obvious temptation not to speak of it at all. For all his failures of character, Harry did have a certain soft charm. And whilst I did not doubt for a moment he had come to Hathaway Hall for his own mercenary purposes, I also knew he was entirely capable of following his capricious heart. That Lady Hathaway had roused his affections, I was certain. I had observed his little courtesies to her at dinner when he thought no one was looking. The dropped spoon he retrieved, silently exchanging it for his own so she did not have to wait to enjoy her pudding. The steadying hand when she rose to leave the table. the quick assessing glances when her colour rose or faded. He was adept at playing the attentive grandson, but even Harry Spenlove was not so gifted an actor as that. He did sincerely care for the old harridan, I was convinced, and unmasking his deceit would unquestionably devastate her, a distinctly unhappy possibility given her state of health. And beside the matter of Lady Hathaway, I had excellent reasons of my own for not exposing Harry's masquerade. When we had been married, the secret of my true parentage was one I had not yet penetrated. Now that he had returned, the revelation that I was the semi-legitimate daughter of the Prince of Wales was not information I cared to share, least of all with an opportunistic, estranged husband. My father and I had never formally met, and I had never been acknowledged, but I had upon more than one occasion been called into service for the family, lending such talents as I possessed. Ours was an uneasy partnership, and I did not even know if I wanted my father's acknowledgement. But if there were ever to be a chance of a relationship with him, Harry could never know. Guarding my own secret seemed a good deal likelier if I gave Harry a wide berth, I reflected, although I had made up my mind that I must somehow find the words to explain my situation to Stoker. Breakfast provided no opportunity, for Stoker had already finished and begun his work in the Long Gallery, according to Charles Hathaway.
"I was hoping you might go to the observatory, Miss Speedwell," he continued. "My sister is still rather sullen about the notion of giving up our grandfather's celestial instruments, and I thought she might be a little more amenable to giving them into your care. She admires you so," he added, with a little sop to my vanity.
I repressed a sigh. All my sympathies lay with Effie, and I had little inclination to be drawn into family quarrels. But before I could frame my refusal tactfully, Mary Hathaway appeared with a few of her offspring.
"Children, say good morning to Miss Speedwell. You remember her, my darlings, the lady scientist."
She managed to make the phrase "lady scientist" sound faintly obscene, but my greater objection was to the children themselves. Geoffrey was still carrying his cage, although I was relieved to see it contained nothing living, and the unlovely Ada was once more sucking at her finger. Her long, straight hair was tied back with a bow so enormous it looked like ears.
"Come, children, let us show Miss Speedwell where the observatory is," she urged. "She is going to speak with your Aunt Euphemia," she told them firmly.
I had promised no such thing, but there seemed little chance of escaping Mary Hathaway's domination as she herded us all up the stairs. Geoffrey walked next to me, one hand clutching my skirts as he waved the little cage at me. I realized then how much it looked like a gibbet and shuddered. "So, no luck catching fairies, then?" I asked meanly. He gave me a dark look.
"You couldn't see it if I had. Fairies can be invisible when they want."
"Then how will you know when you catch one?"
"Because it will scream when I poke it with my stick," he assured me.
We had come to the top of the stairs, and Mary Hathaway looked fondly at her children.
"Such a consolation, children," she said, "and such a responsibility. The rearing of them is extraordinarily taxing," she confided, as she handed them off to their nanny and a small cadre of nursemaids.
"I have no doubt," I said, twitching my skirts out of Geoffrey's sticky grasp before he trotted off with his nanny.
"That is why I appreciate you speaking with Effie," she said. "The sooner those instruments are out of the house, the better."
"But why? Surely there is no harm in Miss Euphemia having a hobby," I protested. Her mouth was set in a firm and unflattering line. If she kept up the habit of disapproving of things, she was going to age very poorly, I reflected.
It is not, I am afraid, merely a hobby. If it were, no matter how unladylike, I might be able to condone it. But Effie wants to pursue science as an occupation, and that is simply not acceptable.
I am doing it, I told her roundly. Her expression turned frankly pitying.
And that is certainly admirable in your case. Spinsters must, after all, earn their crust of bread somehow. But Effie has family and ought to have a husband. She has no call to earn a living. Besides, her unwomanly pursuits have led to other bad habits, she said, pursing again. She consorts with servants, particularly that Anjali who attends Lady Hathaway. I have attempted upon numerous occasions to put a stop to it, but unfortunately Effie is entirely ungovernable, and Anjali is engaged by Lady Hathaway, and I have not the authority to remove her.
You would dismiss her over her friendship with Miss Euphemia?
Friendship?
The word was uttered on a genteel shriek.
Miss Speedwell, I beg you, do not use such a word. It is unthinkable. And I will have my way in the end, she added,
with the complacency of a cat surveying a plump mouse.
But for now, please do what you can to reconcile Effie to the fact that the observatory will be cleared out, whatever her thoughts on the matter.
She leaned near enough that I could smell her toilet water, something heavy with the fragrance of lily, which I have never liked.
Effie, I do not mind telling you, has been only one of my trials here, Miss Speedwell. Lady Hathaway is occasionally imperious, forgetting that she is no longer mistress here. One wants to be tactful.
She trailed off, and I made sympathetic noises. I hated giving any sign of encouraging confidences to someone I found frankly odious, but Mary was, after all, a source of information. And, of course, with the sudden appearance of Jonathan Hathaway, I began. She rolled her eyes heavenwards.
You have no notion the trouble it has caused us. I will not say he has been anything other than helpful with Lady Hathaway. His attentions in that quarter have been entirely welcome. He entertains and soothes her in a way none of the rest of us can. He has saved me a tremendous amount of work, I can tell you. But the scandal, if it were to become public...
She put a fingertip to my sleeve.
I know I can trust your discretion, Miss Speedwell. After all, you are part of an Earl's household,
she added in a tone of respect. I understood her better then. She had the merchant class's view of aristocracy, awed to the point of idiocy. Aristocrats, as I had excellent reason to know, put their trousers on exactly the same as everyone else, and sometimes with far less skill or assistance. That Lord Rosmoren and Stoker's eldest brother, Viscount Templeton Vane, were decent fellows was the exception, not the rule, for noble gentlemen. But I assumed a smile I hoped she would interpret as one of agreement. You must live in terror of the story being published in the newspapers, I suggested. Her own smile was one of accomplished smugness.
Would you believe, Miss Speedwell, one of those dreadful daily tabloids intended to write about it? But my father handled the situation, and we need have no further worry in that quarter, she added, pressing her lips together.
So, her papa's fortune was a source of embarrassment until she had need of it to purchase the Daily Harbinger's silence. I had not thought it possible to dislike her more, but this new hypocrisy had managed to do the trick. Perhaps regretting the mention of her father, or else remembering that it was common to consort with anyone below one's own social station, she drew herself up and bustled away, entirely forgetting to give me instructions on how to reach the observatory. but I did not call her back. I was perfectly delighted to be rid of her, and I fled in the general direction of the observatory. I followed the long corridors of the hall until I came to the small black door set under the portrait of Sir Geoffrey. The knob gave way in my hand, and I bent double to pass through the doorway. Immediately beyond lay a narrow staircase of lacy black metal that twisted upwards, spiralling around itself into the furthest reaches of the tower. My skirts somewhat hampered my progress, but I climbed steadily onwards until at last I reached a small door with a notice pinned to it. The words were printed in heavy block capitals. "Do not enter on pain of death." I smiled and rapped once on the door. Through it, I heard a hasty scrabbling. There was a long delay before a voice called for me to enter.